You are about to enter the pop, pulp, and subcultural minds of several individuals. What may leak into the ether can sometimes be too strange, too confusing for the average human mind. When nerds assemble. Hello, and welcome to episode 12 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
We've got Dave Cookie this week as he's up to a couple of other things. We apologise in advance if the audio is not quite up to whatever is our usual quality. We've been having a few device problems today. Otherwise, though, we've got lots of lovely things to talk to you about this week, ranging from some more cyberpunk to more litigation news, and then we've got a nice tasty topic conversation for to round off the show, looking at 3D in film. But first off, the cyberpunk situation. So, you know, we talked about steampunk and the other punks last week, and it was almost as if CD Projekt, the guys behind The Witcher and The Witcher 2, had somehow been listening. Well, the fact that actually the game had been announced earlier this year, it just hadn't got a title and a whole load of art. But Cyberpunk 2077 is in development. And it has essentially vaguish links with a much, much older game, which until recently I'd never heard of, called Cyberpunk 2020. So I was kind of intrigued. Did anybody else see any of the artwork that they sort of released for it that was looking a bit gory?
Just one or two bits. It looks reasonably nice, but of course that's just concept artwork.
Yeah.
You have to see the game in action. But you were saying you hadn't heard of the RPG.
Yeah, the older title.
Yeah, the original.
Which is a lot older.
Yeah.
So we're talking 1980s.
Yeah, I do have mates who have played it. I haven't. Because no matter what anyone else is, I wasn't that geeky. I have played some pen and paper RPGs, but I haven't played that particular one. I am aware of it, though. But okay. I find it interesting that they're bringing it back in that way.
I was trying to read a blog post from one of the developers before we started recording about this. And they were saying stuff that they think, I think essentially that people tend to blur the line of what is cyberpunk and what's just other SF. And I'm not sure if they themselves maybe quite understand what cyberpunk is, going from some of the art, especially if anyone's seen it, there's a picture of like a woman kneeling and she's got these metal things coming out of her arms with a bit of blood and stuff. And I'm like, cyberpunk, it looks, even though there's blood, it still looks a little too polished in terms of the tech to be quite what punk would be.
When it comes to cyberpunk, it looks like they're going Deus Ex.
Yeah.
With a bit of a Blade Runner.
just a sort of sprinkling.
A sousson of Blade Runner, of Electric Sheep.
I mean, I haven't admittedly seen much more or heard much more about it beyond the concept art and the name that came out last week. I suppose if they're making it like a full-on RPG like The Witcher and The Witcher 2, it could actually be quite an interesting SF game, essentially.
I'm excited by that idea. I do like that idea.
With proper sort of character control and stuff. But what would be nice, obviously, is if, you know, maybe there's some character customization in there that you're not just forced to play as a guy. Be nice. Because, you know, be nice to have a customizable cyberpunk game for once. Not that I'm complaining against what we got with Deus Ex, but, you know.
So, to be fair, I think we just need more female options in games when it comes to, you know, players, because obviously it's not just women that like to play as women, it's also some men that like to play as kind of women.
It also, if you can actually choose gender and stuff, it actually feeds into, there's a lot of cyberpunk's one of those areas in media and literature that's actually got a lot of sort of theory writing and sort of analytical writing from academia about it, and a lot of the stuff about it is about things to do with gender and things. So if you can actually get in some gender issues into the gameplay, that would be kind of cool. And actually having the choice there would be one of the main ways to do that. Mm. And then obviously having people react a bit differently. I mean, it's like with, even though it's subtle, even if you play as a female shepherd in the Mass Effect games.
Yes, it's like, please can we learn from that?
Yeah. There are differences, and if characters occasionally react a little bit differently to you, or the very fact that if the character contrasts so largely from the roles that we expect of particular genders in our contemporary society to then play the character in a role that you didn't expect contemporarily, it's just kind of, it's refreshing, and slightly exotic and yet cool at the same time. So, yeah, I've got hopes, but at the same time, we've been stuck as a guy for the first two Witcher games, which is understandable because of how story-centric it is. But, you know, mix up a little bit.
I was just going to say there, just while I remember. Now, The Witcher is based on novels, isn't it?
Yeah, I think something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so I can see why they would stick with...
Yeah.
A particular character or set of characters, but when it comes to something like the cyberpunk RPG, it the whole idea of it was rolling your character.
Yeah.
With games like that, so if they do a new one like this, it's like, please, you know, run with that idea.
I mean, if you think about it, from my perspective, like being like a film buff. The character of Ripley in Aliens was kind of originally almost had no gender. So why can't we have more of that in stories where, you know, for the most part, the gender doesn't really matter. So, you know, you can choose between the two.
Precisely. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be nice. Moving on to something that actually has a lot of gender issues with it, especially if you watch the original film and read the novel that it's based on.
Goodness.
Carrie, the remake, is a thing. They released a teaser trailer last week. There's lots of blood. There's lots of Carrie standing in the middle of a sort of, you know, average American town. Devastation all around. It's not exactly... You kind of know... I mean, if you don't know what happens in the novel or the original film, then... Okay, maybe the trailer will be lost on you, but basically you know that bad stuff's going to happen. But it's a remake, and we do have slight conflicting feelings about remakes as a podcast.
Yeah. Now, with that, is it a remake of the film, or is it a re-adaptation of the original Stephen King book?
Well, something I read was suggesting that it was a remake... Well, no, a reimagining of adapting it. So it's going straight back to the novel. I swear I read that, you know, one of the directors or writers behind it was saying that they've gone back to the source material and they're trying to really bring it more in. Yeah. Like actually make it more of an faithful adaptation.
So unlike Total Recall, then?
Yeah, we don't talk about that.
Oh dear.
Yeah. So there's hope. I mean, I read Carrie in the past year, and I had previously to that seen the film. There's some aspects of the novel that would perhaps work better if it was given to screen when it previously hasn't been, and there's some stuff that wouldn't be, because like it does, like in the novel, it does take a while for things to develop, whereas in the original film that was made, you know, it's kind of wham, bam. It doesn't take long for stuff to escalate because, you know, it's a film. You've only got a small period of time, and it's not like you're trying to adapt Twilight, which seems to be, you know, mostly, well, the whole series of Twilight books, which is mostly about waiting.
Yeah.
Entire chapters dedicated to waiting around. I mean, Carrie, in the film with Travolta and all that, and it's like, yeah, it swiftly moves through from inciting incident through to the second act, through to the final sort of third act. But in the book, things are a lot slower. And I think with the current sort of situation with Christian fundamentalism. That
my favourite people.
Yeah, that the novel draws upon, and if you consider the current climate in the US on the conservative right or far right, depending on your opinion on that, plus the fact that obviously Red State from Kevin Smith has shown that there's an interest for, you know, sort of slightly horrific movies that involve religious fundamentalists. I think they're going to be pushing that angle more from what I've heard, because there is essentially a market for stuff that explores this sort of deeper, darker side of what faith can bring a person to do.
Now, you see, that could be quite interesting, because that could be explored from several different angles.
Mm. But what I'm unsure from watching the teaser that was released, because you don't see the town close up at all, and Carrie's in her prom dress, but it's all covered in blood and stuff, and I can't really determine whether or not they're saying it in the original time period that the novel was written in, which is something like, what, the 70s?
Yeah,
the 1970s, or if they've brought it forward to now, because it was proper small town America, not much modernization has happened, kind of high street that she's standing in the middle of, but you can't see any cars or storefronts or anything up close.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what decade the film's set in at the moment.
It sounds like they deliberately did that.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, because the thing is that if you're referring back to sort of fundamental systems of belief back in the 70s, it's a bit different to the situation now.
You know, in some ways, it's worse now than it was.
But, you know, so it'll be interesting, and in the sense of, you know, what they do with it, to either A, make it more like the novel, and B, well, what time period it's set in, because, you know, fundamentalism 1970s versus fundamentalism now, two completely different attitudes, and also acceptance by the wider society. I mean, I would certainly argue that fundamentalism has a greater foothold in power than it did back then. So, you know, it could vary. But going back to the novel there were aspects from it. Like, there's like all these reports and stuff in it that, if I remember correctly, like sort of like reports on TK, and its development and stuff, and kind of like stuff that kind of analyzes the aftermath of what happened in the town that Carrie lives in and things. So there's like this whole slightly factual account thing going on. So whether or not they bring in that element,
there's a lot they could do with it.
Yeah. Moving on to other, we've actually got quite a bit of film news this week, because there's been so much going on.
Quite a lot, actually.
Yeah. So, you know, it's probably, along with the Terminator films, probably one of the franchises that's had sequel development hell for a very long time. But Ghostbusters 3 is looking like it'll kick off production next year. But there will be no Bill Murray.
No!
It's probably because he got killed in Zombieland.
Or they could bust him.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
You've just broken me.
The entire idea of a Ghostbusters without Bill Murray. Without Venkman.
Yeah. The man that essentially drove them to, you know, drive around in an old ambulance that looked like it could never pass an MOT for its life. Yeah, it's just kind of like, okay, so, you know, I can understand why maybe where he might want to do it, might not want to do it. It, you know, he's getting on. unless he's pure mentor role. Mentor, not mental, by the way. Mentor. he, you know, there'd be a bit of action involved and stuff. And, you know, for a guy like Bill, you know, maybe he doesn't want to be running around set screaming at ghosts and stuff.
I can understand that. Yeah. But I just thought with them getting all together to voice the game
Yeah.
gave me hope. and it worked quite well. I mean, the game wasn't fantastic, but I did really enjoy it. And
what system did you play it on?
360.
I see. I reviewed it on the Wii, and while it had the while it may have had the cartoony graphics in that, actually, I found it was a lot more fun to play because they really utilized the Wii motion controls. So you were throwing the sort of capture cage and that into the middle of the floor to capture the ghosties. You know, you were really moving the streams around and stuff, and it was actually quite cool.
I kind of like that idea, but then that would be playing it on the Wii.
Yeah. No, what you don't want to play the game on is the Nintendo DS. I also had to review the DS version of the game. And that was appalling. It's the only game I've never completed for a review because I couldn't physically play it because the controls didn't work. They for some stupid reason put the accelerator on the D-pad. Well, the D-pad also had left and right, so you had to press up to accelerate. And then steer by pressing D. But you had to keep on accelerating, or else the car wouldn't move. So, yeah.
You see, yeah, I've played games with controls like that, but that's because I was playing them in the mid-80s, when it was a joystick and one button.
This really didn't work on the DS.
Even if you had an analog stick,
yeah,
it would be okay, but... Yeah.
Why do it that way? Why do it that way when you've got more than one button?
But the interesting thing they bring up the games is that obviously the one that was released a couple of years ago is I do wonder with the fact that they're bringing out the film, hopefully, does it continue on from the events of the game? Because the game was a proper sequel to the first two films.
It was, wasn't it? Because it was paid by Dan Aykroyd, and he effectively said that it was, oh, well, if we're not going to get to make Ghostbusters 3, here's the story.
Yeah.
Do you know why? Well, potential reason for it being, in production hell for so long.
Go on.
If Valve had a hand in it.
Valve.
What? If Valve had a hand in it.
Well, just because of their track record with certain other franchises and that. You're telling me that they're perhaps behind every form of development hell ever to take place in the media industry.
If it was Valve under a number 3, exactly, they don't have a good record with that.
Exactly.
speaking of another 3, oh my god. Iron Man 3 synopsis came out last week, in fact, which really wasn't a synopsis because it was kind of taking the mick. It was a couple of vague paragraphs about basically, you know, peril and Iron Man, more peril, bad guys, threats to existence, you know, that kind of thing. But then just to top it off for vagueness, they decided to release a teaser for a teaser trailer. When you hopefully listen to this, the full teaser trailer will be available online. I think it's going to be on Apple Trailers. So, you know, you can go watch it then. But as we record this, all we've so far got is the teaser for the teaser trailer. So it's not even a full trailer, apparently, that's been released tomorrow. It's a teaser trailer. So we've had a teaser for a teaser trailer.
We've had all of 18 seconds.
Yes. Where we just see peril.
And Iron Man, and
stuff happens to Pepper by the looks of things. And it's just like, well, that was kind of expected. Was I right in thinking that I saw, Rhodey's Iron Man suit done up in red and blue? Or was I imagining that?
You could well have, because there were several Iron Man suits.
Yeah.
There was a whole selection.
Because I was... and then I think I read something before we went online, like it looks like the Mandarin's definitely a bad guy in this. And the thing is that I sort of took out from the library recently two random Iron Man trades as part of the Stark Resilient storyline, which is weird in of itself. Like... prior to the point I read, so I hadn't read like the four volumes prior to volumes 5 and 6. Like something happens and Tony has to like wipe his entire memory to stop something else horrible from happening.
What
And he's made like a backup of his brain or something prior to that, but he thought he'd never have to wipe his own brain, so the backup was only so up to date.
So when
he installs the backup in his brain, it's only got like events up to a certain point, and apparently he did a whole load of horrible things before wiping his brain.
What?
And his company's completely bust and stuff. And so he's finally looking into making the arc reactor technology a proper consumer product, powering cars and everyday electronics and our homes.
And here we have the reason why they're rebooting the universes.
I have no idea where overall this stands, but apparently I think the series won an Eisner. So apparently it's okay. But anyway, so the reason I'm confused when I saw the red and blue stripes, it may have been War Machine or Ready Suit or whatever thing in the teaser for the teaser, was that the red and blue stripes and whatnot resembled a lot of the design, except for the size, of a sort of combat suit that's in these comics I've been reading recently.
Well, like an army one.
It's not an army. It's basically because Hammer's like I think dead or something at this point. And it's like his wife and daughter or something that's like running Hammer Industries.
I am completely lost here.
So Stark, because the company's gone completely tits up since he reset his brain, and he's trying to start another company that has nothing to do with weapons. Meanwhile, Hammer's producing like new weaponry and, you know, combat machines, which have people kind of syncing up to the machines using spinal implants or something. And they call this big robot thing Detroit Steel. And the thing is, though, is that the stuff looked similar to Detroit Steel's paintwork, the thing that was in the trailer that I saw. So whether or not they're following this weird storyline, and it just happened that the end of the two volumes that I got, Mandarin turns up. So I'm thinking to myself, did I just happen to be reading the random bit of comic that maybe they're following? Maybe. But no.
The thing is, I read Iron Man, it must have been in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I remember quite liking it, but this is all sounding this is all over the place to me.
My favourite older Iron Man moment was from a 1992 comic I read, and weird stuff had been going on in this one anyway, but they realised that Hammer was up to no good, and it's it being 1992 that, you know, Tony says to like Rhodey and the guys before they head out, it's Hammer time.
Oh, Jesus.
Because it's 1992 and that's supposedly cool.
Wait. I think I see a tumbleweed.
Yeah, I can just see an Iron Man suit with massive trousers.
Oh, yeah.
The advantage of things like this, I mean, the problem that the comics have, which is why they keep having to, you know, reboot them when you're talking about superhero series, is that there's only so much they can do before they start jumping the shark.
Yeah.
And then it's just, we have to build on this and then build on that, and that's something that happened, and they all get increasingly ridiculous, and they go, right, reset, you can start again, so we can just ignore all the crap that we don't want, and maybe keep some of the things that we do. But at least with the films, they can cherry pick things as they go along.
The interesting thing is that I think Batman is probably one of the few exceptions to that rule.
Yeah,
I think.
Maybe.
What would you say, Emily?
Batgirl. I don't know, because they've done. I wouldn't want to be Batgirl. I'd be Batwoman. Thank you.
Yeah,
that's far more awesome. But I don't know. I think, to be honest, there's only a couple of things put out basically by DC or Marvel, or several of their sort of corresponding imprints that are kind of immune from being confusing if you haven't read the backstory. But I'm afraid for the life of me right now, I can't think what the heck they would be. I mean, some of the series have got their own standalone titles, like The Killing Joke's its own thing in Batman.
Yeah.
but those and the stuff that Kevin Smith's been writing in the past few years for Batman, the cacophony and the winding guy, which loads of people hate, those are their own thing. So, but in the terms of the main universes and stuff, and the fact that DC over the decades have had to have the crises to sort things out every now and then, I think that's sign enough that maybe things do get a bit too convoluted. And I personally think that they're missing out on money, because it's so hard to figure out where to start reading things.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
People get overwhelmed by the idea of starting to read the back catalogue for a particular character or team. And but then
that's the problem you're going to have if you're just going to have one character ongoing. How on earth are you going to continue that? And if you're going to have any causality within that universe. I mean, unless you do The Simpsons.
I mean, unless you have causality.
It's almost like a soap opera in a way, because, you know, people obviously get into soap operas, but, you know, most of the people that watch EastEnders and Coronation Street have been watching it from the beginning. They've kind of come in halfway through.
Yeah, but unlike a soap opera, in the comics, the characters rarely die or stay dead for long. So there's the causality kind of fails, because characters keep coming back. But anyway, moving on to more superhero type things. But this is more comics and films and stuff. So after our conversation about the Superman litigation with Siegel's daughter writing that impassioned letter to fans, a judge made a ruling on the Schuster side of the sort of Superman rights and said that an agreement made in 1992 it sort of overwrote a previous one that was closer to the weird copyright law that they're trying to use, meaning that they can't do some weird termination thing that basically means that Warner wins on that front. Now, unlike what some sites are reporting, which the BBC were kind of being a bit unaware of this, but it means that
it's comics, and you really
it's comics, and the legal stuff's over, and it's like, no, the legal stuff isn't over, because there's still the Siegel's stuff that needs to be heard. Plus, I think the Schuster's family's probably still going to try and, you know, get it through into court and, you know, have more rulings made on it. So it's anything but over, whoever was saying. I think Hollywood Reporter, who will be linked to in the Storify entry for this episode, were being a bit more realistic about the whole thing. It's like, yeah, this ruling's happened, it's still going to be in court. But it probably means that, you know, Warner's safe to release Man of Steel next year, essentially.
So just get it sorted. I don't really care at this point.
Yeah. So that's all I've got to say on that, because that's obviously this update on that. But for those who didn't hear last week, we have got a Halloween survey going at the moment on SurveyMonkey. We'll be linking to it in the post for this episode, but please, please take part in the survey, because it will be helping us basically form our podcast for Halloween, which we'll be recording next week. It'll be extra spooky. Lots of spooky. There's going to be sound effects and stuff. That's how spooky it's going to be.
And not just the normal sound effects of us.
Yeah. So, you know, it's going to be brilliant. But moving on from SurveyMonkey surveys for Halloween and Superman and all those superheroes, though. Anyway, we're still going to be talking about superheroes probably. Is time running out for 3D?
Yes. Please, God, yes.
We're asking this because basically Dread, which you couldn't see, at least in the UK, in anything but 3D. It wasn't available in 2D at all. You could only see in 3D. It performed abysmally at the box office, apparently, grossing basically much less than it needed to. Of course, once it hits DVD and Blu-ray, that could be an entirely different story. But people are saying that it was because it was only available in 3D. And that's why, you know, it didn't make money.
It was a stupid decision because, I mean, if they were going to be doing it in a clever way, if they were doing it exclusively in 3D, then sell the tickets cheaper if you've got no choice.
Not a bad idea.
Yeah, it's just if you're forcing all the cinemas to show it in 3D, then, you know, have that cost spread, so to speak. The fact that people were walking up to the kiosk and, oh, well, there's Dread 3D, it's going to cost, in my case, over £10 to see it.
Oh, blimey.
Yes.
Is that including, like, popcorn and whatnot, or...?
No.
That was my chair and glasses.
I think it's at this point perhaps prudent to mention that in the local cinemas in Cornwall, it's rare, if ever, I do believe any of the branches that we've got, because we've got a couple of very small sort of chains. None of them, their main, even for 3D, their basic ticket price is usually less than £8 for a sitting. But they do charge like a quid for like 3D glasses, but you can reuse them. In case Paul B's wondering why the prices, basically prices are country crazy for cinema. But then again, you guys have got more multiplexes.
Yeah.
Which I have a feeling is part of the issue behind that.
Now, we have one cinema in Carlisle now, and that's View.
How many screens?
It's got a few. It's the biggest that we've ever had, let's put it that way, but that's not really saying that much.
Well, has it got more than four screens?
Yes.
You see, that's the top number of screens that our nearest cinema's got. Most of the cinemas in Cornwall, the few of them that there are, don't exceed four screens. And if they do, those extra screens are really tiny.
Yeah, they really, really are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, up until a few years ago when View opened up and that effectively crushed the local cinemas, the largest we had three screens.
Okay.
And then it had a tiny one, which was effectively... about three rooms the size of a biggish living room with a screen at the end. And that was their sort of backup, separate but not really, cast-off cinema where, you know, the small films and the no longer big films would get chucked. So View Cinema is the biggest that we've had. And, it's quite big, but it's... obviously more expensive, but people like that for some stupid reason.
The article that I saw that was suggesting that going back to the whole Dread and 3D thing, the popularity of Dread shows that 3D's dying. I think it's a bit unfair because it's one of the few 18 rated films.
Yeah, that's true.
Used 3D tech.
There are a number of reasons why Dread could have filled at the cinema, and I don't think it's specifically 3D.
Yeah, but I would say overall, looking at 3D options, I know there's a lot of people that are recently become frustrated with films only being available in 3D, and that's because it looks like about at least maybe 30% of the population can't actually see 3D properly, or if they can see it, it actually causes them intense pain after a while.
Which is why it's awesome. It's another reason why 3D is awesome.
Because it causes migraines.
But, I mean, the thing is that with film technology, most other kind of film technologies like high definition and whatnot, they even if you've got bad eyesight or whatnot, it doesn't affect you in like a negative way. You know, you can still watch it. You just won't get any benefit from it. But the fact that the 3D ones actually do affect you in a bad way is a major kind of off-put.
And the 3D effect relies on you staring at a flat surface. So, fixed focal point. And then forcing the 3D effect by, you know, showing you two slightly different images. It's not how normal 3D vision works with the eye. So, it's all a very false thing.
Also, with a lot of the effects use, I'm not sure if it's stuff that's filmed in 3D or certainly stuff that has it done in post-production, but the whole friggin' stuff being dark and blurry, like fight scenes in 3D are often appalling. I think the one film that really annoyed me that used 3D was the fourth Pirates of the Caribbean film. Because there was just so much of the film where you couldn't see what the heck was going on. You couldn't tell who was who when it was fight scenes and stuff going on. And it was in sort of like bluish kind of lighting and stuff. And nothing was distinguishable. And I was just like, well, what? you really couldn't tell what the heck was going on in the screen when they were using 3D. Because that's the thing, it's not the whole film isn't necessarily in 3D. It's bits in 3D, mostly when there's action, and then the rest is in 2D.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like the 3D is almost just layered pictures. So, you know, you obviously get kind of the motion of like a character and whatnot. But that's in 2D, and it's almost like a background's been behind them.
Would it be almost sort of like motion comics?
Yes, in a way, yeah.
When you have the characters, you know, flying, but obviously they're just, you know, they're completely flat.
Yeah.
And maybe tilting a little bit, but just moving. I've heard that with some films. I mean, I've seen two films of the recent crop in 3D, and that was Tron Legacy.
Okay.
And Dread 3D. Now, Tron Legacy, obviously, it was, you know, quite well lit with, you know, all the suits and the lights. So that wasn't really a problem. But then the 3D wasn't really that noticeable in it. With Dread, it was being sort of shoved down your throat whether you wanted it or not. Because there were several bits in it where it was just, there was something blurry quite close to the camera. So and the action, you know, whatever it was being shown through it. Like, almost, you know, Christmas tree lights, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Can I just say with Tron Legacy, from what I remember from watching it in the cinema in 3D, I did notice that basically the real world of it, that was completely 2D, but it was the in the kind of programs themselves and whatnot.
They did say that.
So I presume to kind of emphasize a sense of almost a hyper reality type thing.
Yeah, it didn't work.
I mean, I think looking at Dread and the use of 3D in that film, I mean, sure, there was a lot of action stuff on screen. And of course, there's the whole slow-motion thing that they were doing, which was essentially bullet time. But that was to represent people who were using the drug that features in the film, the slow-mo.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, well, you know what? Sort of like, well, let me think about... 14 years ago, there's The Matrix... There's no 3D there. Managed to do slow motion that worked quite well.
Yeah, it didn't need the 3D.
And it didn't need the 3D. And I would argue that with all the stuff that was going on with Dread, it didn't need the 3D either. It didn't add anything. It was, stuff was maybe popping out of the screen a little bit. But the way they'd choreographed everything and the lighting they'd used and the other effects, it was kind of like, well, no, it looks pretty enough. And I wasn't really ever feeling the benefit of stuff coming out at me.
Not in the slightest. And just the way they made everything look hyper real when people were on the slow-mo drug.
Yeah.
You know, they made everything twinkle so there was more rainbow refraction on water droplets and blood. And, you know, the colours were popping out. That's all you needed. You didn't need the 3D effect at all.
Yeah, it's not just the only. It's only one film I still argue that I've seen that's used 3D to an effect that the stuff is popping out at you in an appropriate degree, and that was The Final Destination, which is the fourth film in the franchise. Paul B, would you agree with me on that one?
Yeah, I'd actually agree. Yeah, it actually. Well, the way that it did it, most notably, I think when one of the characters kind of gets like a spike through the almost like the back of the head and like comes out the throat,
right?
And it makes it more kind of visceral, kind of thing. So if it actually looks like it's more poking out of the mouth,
yeah. But then that's just relying on the old thing of having things pop out from the camera.
Yeah, yeah,
and. I'll just say, I remember, you know, my whole thing with 3D when it was first, you know, coming into, you know, a big thing after Avatar. And people, oh, 3D is the future. It's the future of cinema and of home, you know, Blu-ray and such. Now, the problem I had with that whole idea was that have either of you seen Jaws 3?
No.
No.
You're not missing much. But I saw it in the cinema when it was Jaws 3D.
Oh, yeah. I've seen parodies of that in a certain Back to the Future film.
Yeah. And it was... now, you know, people, you know, who were defending 3D were saying, oh, it's not the red and green glasses anymore. You have proper, you know... Mm. I forget the term that they use.
Well,
but they're
of,
effectively...
polarizing filters on there.
Yeah, that's it. Polarizing. Thank you. You know, it's like that. And it's, well, isn't that interesting? Because excuse me, while I dig up my original Jaws 3D glasses, which I still have somewhere, they are the same. They're polarizing. Mm. They weren't red and green. So I've seen all this before. That was the annoying thing about 3D. It was just, you know, you've done this before. You were trying to do films in 3D using this technique. Yes, it kind of works, but it's all gimmicky.
Yeah, because the only thing you can use it for is to have stuff popping out. Otherwise, you might as well just make sure you record in a decent high definition quality and really go to town with your color palette and also your camera angles. Because essentially with the 3D thing, all it is about is having stuff popping out. Well, unless you're going to have a full hologram setup and go for a holodeck like in Star Trek.
Oh, which would be awesome. We can all agree that would be awesome.
Yeah, no, unless you're going to have that, it would just be stuff popping out of the screen. You're not necessarily going to feel like you're right there. And the way that it makes your eyes focus in order to look at the screen, I would say, from a natural perspective, it disinclines you towards feeling like you're looking at something that's there with you, because the actual process of trying to watch a 3D film to me is quite distracting because of the way it tries to control your eyes.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was saying with the you know, the focal point.
Yeah.
You can't adjust your eyes to look at something, you know, to get rid of a double image or, you know, whatever, or, you know, any, you know, what you'd call a 3D artifact.
Mm.
You can't refocus because it's there. It's there is no focal length, so your mind is saying, I'm wanting to focus on that, so it stops being blurry, but I can't do anything.
I mean, film has always kind of progressed to a kind of try to make things as realistic as possible. Obviously, with kind of like glasses that kind of go quite around, you know, almost like the back of your head, almost like having a 360 degree type thing. And in the end, it's always going to fail. Trying to get that much realism.
Yeah.
I'll say, on the realism side of things, actually, when they apply it to frigging kids' films, where's the realism there? So these really...
Yeah.
It's rarely... I mean, is the new Monsters, Inc., I assume Disney's making that in 3D, because they seem to have so much vested in it now. So maybe seeing, like, Sully's hair in 3D or something could be quite cool.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of kids' films, actually. It's not even adult films for adults. It's kids' films. It's kids for the under-8s. For the under-8s that are seriously getting the 3D treatment. You know, or say under-8s, under-10s. The funny thing, okay, cinemas recommend that, I think, is it like 3 years plus?
Yeah.
For sort of youngest for seeing the cinema. But isn't it something like up to the age of 6 or 8, you can't actually watch 3D films because of the technology that's used. The kids' eyes.
Yeah, I've seen all kinds of warnings saying do not let kids, you know, below a certain age.
Yeah. So then there's a huge chunk of the target market for the films, these kids' films. They can't even watch the kid films anyway because they're in 3D, and because they're pushing the 3D more because they can charge more for the tickets, you basically got a whole bunch of the market, you know, that's been adversely affected.
I mean,
by the use of the technology.
If you kind of put in film and computer games side by side, in actual fact, the 3DS is better because you can actually turn it off. You can turn the 3D off. You can't do that with the cinema, can you?
No, you're stuck with it. I mean, and the whole thing, I mean, what gets me really about 3D is that it's a drive towards profits, both from them being able to sell the tickets for more in the cinema to, oh, you bought an HD TV. Well, that's nice, but it's still in 2D, isn't it? You really need a 3D one now. And I look at the program planner on Sky, and oh, there's one channel. And I look at the HD list, you know, which is, you know, long and getting longer. And, you know, oh, yes, there's plenty of HD content there. I'm quite happy with my HD TV. Thank you very much. 3D, I'd be feeling so pissed off. And with oh, look at Avatar. That made so much money. That just proves that 3D is the future. No. All it proved is that there are big blockbuster films which can bring in the punters.
Funny enough, I thought there was this thing that dude that made Avatar managed to make in the 90s that didn't use 3D that made hundreds of millions at the box office as well. Maybe I just imagined that.
Hold on, didn't they 3D-ify that one as
they
well?
They did afterwards, yes, after Avatar. After it already made its millions upon millions upon millions, they went and added 3D to it retroactively.
Yeah, it's just James Cameron and various other directors have the punch and have the talent of being able to make films which will be huge successes.
Yeah, but 3D is not necessarily a part of that.
Yeah, 3D is a thing.
You know, in other circles, I mean, if we go back to this figure that I've seen that apparently 30% of people can't see 3D properly, and you're making a blockbuster, you're spending, I don't know, something crazy like over $200 million developing this film, and 30% of the potential age group audience can't actually watch the thing properly. I'd be kind of worried about that, actually, if I was looking for returns.
If 30% of the population had red-green colour blindness, and you made a film which relied, one's red, one's green, they're twins! You know, and the entire thing hinged on that as a selling point, and you'd have 30% of the population saying, well, I can't tell the bastards apart.
And not going to see the film subsequently or spending their money.
That does make me wonder, actually, with the colour blindness and the old red-green glasses, whether people who had the red-green colour blindness actually had problems with those.
I would have thought they must have done.
I can partially answer that because I'm not colourblind, but my left eye is far weaker than my right.
Okay.
So polarised glasses, you know, the polarised 3D, I can see that fine. Mm. But when it came to the red-green glasses, because it relied on, you know, being able to hide the other colour.
Yeah.
That never quite worked for me.
Okay. So it almost like the picture had kind of almost like one of its dimensions, as it were, kind of was like really fuzzy or blurry.
Yeah, I could see a ghost image, and the 3D effect on the red green, you know, pages and such didn't quite work. But yeah, when it comes to actually, you know, sitting down with polarized glasses, it's like, yeah, they work. They're still annoying in their own special way, but I can't see the 3D.
I took to Twitter earlier to ask people what they thought about 3D. You know, is it you know, nigh that it's coming to its end, sort of thing? And I got Cross Channel Film Lab, who might have a slight interest in 3D still being about, says they get quite excited about the possibilities of using 3D in new ways. And then they linked, and you'll be able to get to it from the Storify. They linked to a blog post they'd done about how 3D apparently brings us closer to character characters in films. I was like, okay. Then Chris Jacobs or Sergeant Benton said, outside of IMAX, probably, as in, you know, outside of IMAX, then there probably will no longer be a market soon for 3D films. I mean, in a way, it's a bit ridiculous how, for smaller cinemas, certainly, how 3D restricts them. Because they've obviously got, they're going to have one projector at least that's sort of almost dedicated 3D.
Yeah.
But if it wasn't, then they'd actually be able to show a greater range of films, because yeah. they wouldn't be just restricted to sort of the 3D films on that one projector, and then they have to cram up the other screens with sort of like 2D, or try to, but they've only got one screen that's got 3D. At least that's the case of our local cinema.
Yeah, and they have to go on a high rotation if they want to get, you know, if there's more than one at once.
Yeah.
Can I just say that I think to a certain extent the very nature of how films work kind of means that 3D isn't actually effective. Basically, if you think about a shot of like a man running down a road. Now, yeah. If you have that shot side on, that man is, you know, running, and you kind of have to either keep up with him, or, you know, he's running really fast past the camera. Now, if you actually try to use depth in film, what you'd actually see is that man running, like, slowly getting smaller as he gets further away from the camera. That doesn't actually work in the sense of kind of pace, really. Well, with a lot of films, anyway.
I think, well, just as you were saying, I think 3D puts far more restriction on the whole art.
Mm.
You know, colour, you can use colour in a certain ways, or you can just use what's there, and it will still work really well. But 3D, you have to have things, you know, going away or, you know, towards.
I mean, I think overall from, like, maybe the filmmaker's perspective, I mean, 3D costs more to make a film in 3D, which means that it's going to cost more. It's going to be harder to get investors interested in backing a film. And of course, if things like Dread, and I think there's been a couple of others that haven't done too well recently, they've been shot and then shown mostly, if only, in 3D, and they haven't been doing well. Then, quite frankly, I think it will be the studios and the investors and the shareholders who will kill off 3D anyway, because the audience has already done the business.
Yeah, that they've told them with their money that we don't want it, really.
Yeah.
Now, what I find interesting here is that of all the companies, when it comes to entertainment, when you're talking TV, cinema, and games, Sony has got, you know, one of the biggest stakes when it comes to 3D production and what you can use to see it. Now, I found it very interesting when they were talking to Eurogamer a few weeks back, and they were asked about the less prevalent 3D push that they're putting up, on their products on, you know, PlayStation 3. And the guy said, our consumers have made it clear that it's not a priority at the moment.
Wow, if even Sony say that, I mean, they're famous for basically coming up with all sorts of proprietary, you know, stuff. Blu-ray was I think originally kind of proprietary, although other companies kind of got involved in that. But before that there were like mini discs, before that Betamax. So they've always kind of been there and, you know, had alternate technologies. I mean, even memory cards, they've got the Memory Stick Duo. That, you know, like PSPs and whatnot use.
And they'll always say, oh no, people love A-Track. Which is why people love Minidisc. You know, all that kind of thing. They'll say, people love our stuff. But, you know, for one of them to actually say, ah, it's not a priority, that's why we're not pushing it to people now.
I got a funny A-Track bloody story. I used to have a Sony Minidisc player. It still might be somewhere hidden away. Obviously making mini discs on it, recording burning music from my laptop or whatever to it. And it would do it as our track format. And, what's that? I took one of the mini discs into the sound suites where I used to go to college. And it was a Sony, you know, mini disc stack that I found. I put the mini disc in, showed up the title information. Could I actually get the audio from said mini disc to play on the Sony system?
Sony format on Sony hardware.
That wasn't working.
On the Sony storage medium.
Yeah. however, a friend that had a disc they'd made with like a Philips mini disc recorder, which recorded it on an MP3, that played.
Oh, irony.
But I think that's all we've got time for on the lovely subject of 3D in films and games. And technology is maybe not quite taking off. And the fact that really, guys, we need you to be working on the holodeck. Stop messing around with frigging glasses and adjustable screens, eh?
Yeah, computer, or at least just, arch.
Or at least just proper holograms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, work on it. You know, I think that's what we really want. It's fudge for 3D. It's a distraction. We want holograms. But yeah, that's all we've got time for this week. So this has been the Nerd Assemble podcast. I'm Emily. You can find me on Twitter at EK6891. You can find the Nerd Assemble podcast at www.nerdassemble.co.uk, on Twitter at Nerds Podcast. We're on Facebook as Nerds Assemble Podcast. We're also on Google Plus under that monkey. Do you guys want to say bye?
Well, I'll just say I'm Paul Wood. I'm Retroid on Eurogamer.net and Super Retroid on Twitter.
Okay, is it my turn?
Yes.
Yep. Okay. I'm Paul Blewett. You can find me on Twitter under Paul Blewett, and I have website Paul Blewett. There's a dash in there. And there's a .com at the end as well.
Okay, we'll be back to normal next week with Cookie. And it'll be our Halloween special. So we hope you're looking forward to it as much as we are recording it. Good night.
Well,
good night.
Bye.